November 2022, Upside Foods was the first company to receive regulatory approval for its cultivated chicken in the USA. Eric Schultz was a former FDA employee there and was instrumental in getting that approval. He was a co-author of the dossier, which has been used as a template for so many companies since then. He's now founded Good Human, which is a consultancy looking at public policy and helping companies integrate scientific management with regulatory demands. In this podcast, Eric provides insights into the workings of the regulatory bodies and gives his opinion on the UK sandbox and much more. I'm Alex Crisp and welcome to another episode of Future of Foods Interviews. All episodes are available on Substack where you can subscribe for free. Thank you very much, Eric Schultz, for coming on to Future of Foods Interviews. You've had quite a varied career so far, coming from FDA and then working at Upside Food. And now you've started a new venture called Good Human. Could you just give us a little introduction to yourself and the work you're doing there at Good Human?
Sure. First off, thank you for having me.
Pleasure.
Good Humans is really just an extension of the work that I've been doing throughout most of my career, which has been primarily, one, building companies that already work in the bioeconomy, biotechnology space. So food companies, biotechnology, biopharma. The other aspect is fractional C-suite. So some companies can't afford a chief scientific officer right away. So I come in to do that, or chief regulatory officer, or sometimes founding CEO. So I'm there to fill in the gap. And then lastly, working with integrating all of this science and management across public policy, which is sorely needed in the bioeconomy. And a lot of people don't know how to even deal with that. So government affairs, public policy. So it's always at the forefront of the bioeconomy and basically helping people feed more people or reverse climate change.
Okay. So Good Humans is a consultancy firm of sorts, is it?
Yes, basically hired guns, but in a very unique, I think the aspect that makes it most interesting to me is the fact that it integrates public policy as well, which is not common, and having people think through how their science is going to impact the public, which is much more important than people give it credit for, especially in an emerging technology space.
So I suppose you have the quite unique advantage of working on both sides of the fence for the FDA and then for Upside. What inspired your transition from regulatory work into entrepreneurship and the food innovation sector?
When I worked at FDA, I got to see the coolest things come through, and I got to see my work matter on a very public scale. The problem was I also killed a lot of industries. And not because we wanted to, but because companies weren't ready for regulation. They didn't understand policy. And the other aspect was I watched rooms full of scientists in the government come up with very nuanced and thoughtful answers to ways forward on policy. And then I watched usually one single lawyer in the room veto the entire discussion. And I was like, I want to know why that kind of power exists and why aren't more scientists involved in that level of influence? And so putting those two together, I was like, how can I go put all this into one space? I was committed to, I think I can get a product, a new food product through federal regulation without creating any new laws, any new regulations, and do it faster. I wanted to prove to the public and myself that this was possible. And so I did. I became employee number 7 at Upside Foods, then Memphis Meats. I was their first senior hire. And on top of it, I wanted to show that the science in that had been developing could be moved through a regulatory system much faster. At the time, the average time to an approval from a new idea at FDA to out on the world was about 7 to 12 years. And at Upside, I was able to get the first cultivated meat product out to market in 11 months, reducing the time to market by 90%.
Wow. It must have been quite an endeavor. I suppose Upside Foods really needed somebody on the inside to get that stuff done initially, because it was such a brand new space. They wouldn't have had any kind of framework in place for that, right?
Correct. There was not. And it took quite a few years of negotiating with the US government to be able to establish a framework, which at the time Upside led. And again, Ups and Uma, the founder, with his foresight, was like, you know what, I'm going to take a bet on this wet behind the ears regulator. I was very young still, and I moved across country sight unseen. I'd never lived in San Francisco, didn't really know much about it from Washington, D.C. And I gave up my very good, rewarding government job, my corner office, and all of that jazz to work in a cubicle in San Leandro, California for pennies. It was more of an experiment on our side to see if we could do it, and we did. And now people are copying it, which makes me really happy.
Clearly, you saw the potential in Upside at
Oh,
that.
yeah.
Yeah.
I was running another organization in DC at the time, which required, it was a science communication organization. And I wrote most of the talks, but in general, I needed a monologue and I needed topics to introduce the show. And I remember coming across then Memphis Meats in Reddit, on Reddit. And I saw that they lowered the cost to $18,000 a pound. And I was like, that's a huge improvement. Because I knew that in 2011, Google had done it. Sergey Brin had done it with, I'm sure you talked, because you've talked with the Mark Post, for about $300,000 a pound. So that was a big improvement. I was like, they're going to do this. Oh, they're going to need help. They're going to need communications help. They're going to need regulatory help. They're going to need public policy. They're going to need science help. On top of it, I'm a professional scientist. And it turns out Upside Foods was actually using my doctoral research as some of their cell line development work. So they were familiar with me. And so I just basically said, you're going to get like a three for one if you hire me. And so during the day, I would genetically engineer the cells and try to understand how we were going to produce a product. And then at night, I would moonlight as a federal regulator.
Yeah. I guess with these, I worked for a regulator as well. So I used to work for Ofcom, and then I went to industry actually, but it was in a different space. So I understand that some of the times it's just about your relationships, isn't it? It's the people there. You know their names and you can actually get straight to them and get answers to your questions pretty quickly rather than being put into a queue for 6 months.
Yeah, it's that, and you're right. There's a aspect of just treating them like human beings on the other end. They're not just like government automatons. And on top of that, you know this, like there's a certain way to play the game. You have to know how to say the words in the right way at the right time, what not to say, and those cultural norms, those institutional norms that associate themselves with the regulatory body, being able to do that basically just sends us an implicit signal of trust and maturity, rather than this is a fly-by-night organization that a regulatory body doesn't want to spend time with. But on top of that, I was also building the government affairs and public policy. I was splitting my time between San Francisco and DC. Ironically, ended up spending a ton of time in DC working for Upside, working with Congress, USDA, FDA, and all of the White House at the time as well, to build bridges across this sector, because there was a lot of antagonism early on.
So, what's the situation like now then, Eric? Is the USA open for business? What do you think in regard to FDA and their kind of recent actions? What is there any insights you can give there?
Yes, I still think that the US has the most permissive and rigorous risk evaluation system in the world for food safety. It gets knocked a lot, I think. And I understand some of the criticism, by the way, for how it evaluates or fails to evaluate certain food ingredients. But for novel technologies, there, I would argue that the Upside Good Meat and Mission Barns cultivated pork fat are the most studied new food ingredients ever put in the food supply. So I think for new things, for new food ingredients and food additives, I don't think you can get beat, you can be beaten by FD, by anyone other than FDA. But that said, it's taken a long time to get this third approval. And I worked on, full disclosure, I worked on the Mission Barnes approval. I think what's important to realize is, like, most companies who are seeing delays right now are because they are regulatorily immature. They don't know how to play the game. They don't have the resources to spend because regulation is expensive. And they end up doing, as again, someone who worked at FDA, companies would make decisions early on in their product design space, and they would come to FDA at the end, and it would be a fatal flaw that we would say, there's no way to make this safe. You have to go back and redo it. And it would be a $20 million, a $10 million mistake. Those companies would fold.
I suppose there are a number of companies waiting in line, aren't there? And think of companies like Blue Nalu who've been knocking at the door for a few years.
Yes, there's estimated about somewhere between 30 and 40 active applications at FDA in the queue. Yeah, there's quite a wait. And the other issue is that FDA, I spoke with Susan Main, the former center director who ran the food side of FDA for 10 years, and she was my boss at one point. There's not enough people to do the work. Like, they have people that do the work, which is great, but for the last 20 years, Susan Main and others have been asking for Congress to provide more resources to hire more people. And now with RFK Jr. running HHS, the Human Health Services, and then by proxy, FDA, he's asked for even stricter food additive evaluations, but also has not authorized more staff. Ultimately, we need more people working at FDA to cover this and get these products through.
Yeah. So it's 30 companies in the kind of cultivated fish, meat, fats sector that are in the queue.
It's an estimate. There's probably more that have
Right.
spoken FDA but have not filed. Keep in mind, just to
Okay.
get a file name, you have to be pretty advanced in the
Yeah.
process. So many companies have probably had introductory conversations, but actually haven't filed. So I would argue you could probably double that number and be pretty consistent. So I would say 60 companies are at least talking to FDA.
Yeah, it's interesting what you're saying about staff as well, because I have been told similar things about the FSA in the UK. They have a bit of a shortage. I'm sure they'd hate me saying that, but I think there is a
Let's
shortage.
talk about FSA. FSA is running the sandbox program, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and they
Yeah.
announced all the companies. And again, full disclosure, I'm working with some of the companies in the sandbox program. I think objectively, the sandbox program is a great idea. I love this for regulators. I love that it's a way for them to learn. The problem, my main criticism of a sandbox program is that you basically get no approvals for X amount of time. Like, you're basically saying, industry, you will not be on market until X years in the future. And that drives me crazy because and this is where that necessary tension between regulators and regulated industry that I know you're very familiar with emerges, where companies are like, I got to burn cash waiting for you to figure out how to regulate me. And you just get to sit back and make a decision. And I think the sandbox program is ultimately a net positive, but I do think there's a substantive critique in there around, how do you offset the burn that's going to happen in the companies that will go under while they wait for you to approve? And I think what's going to happen is they're going to go to other countries that have a direct path through. And in this case, it's probably FDA in the US. Maybe it's Health Canada. Maybe it's Singapore. And so I think ultimately they need to either offset I don't think there's going to be a subsidy program, but offsetting the cash these companies spend while they're waiting in the program, or they have a different way of saying, we guarantee an approval, assuming you meet X, Y, and Z at this time.
Yeah, I did say something quite similar to that when they announced the sandbox, because everyone was celebrating it, but I was just thinking, what, 2 years? Really?
That's a lifetime at a startup.
I know there was a, because they had a sandbox in Israel, and yes, it was Aleph Farms. They were then approved within 11 months or something from the sandbox initiation. So
Right.
it's not necessary for it to take 2 years, I don't think.
I'm also speaking of Israel as well. I'm still waiting for them to release any information about their approval. I know that the teams over there and those companies are still waiting to get their manufacturing licenses, which is anywhere in the world is very expensive to convert your facility to GMPs, good manufacturing practices. But I haven't seen any information from Singapore or Israel on how did they make their decision about the safety. I will say, criticize FDA all you want about it, and I think that's fair, but they do publish their work. If you can go read like 30-page analyses of the dossiers, and then
Yeah.
the companies release the dossiers publicly, so you can review them. We haven't seen one document from either country about any of the approvals. So I think there's a lot more work to be done globally to harmonize how we review the safety of these products.
I wonder whether there is, in that regard, whether the companies have asked for their dossiers to remain private, because clearly there's detail in there that they might not want to share.
I'm unfamiliar with Israeli law, but I am familiar with Singaporean law because I worked with SFA to help design their regulatory system for cultivated. And they have explicit secrecy laws that forbid the SFA from releasing any company information at all. But in the US, we have the Freedom of Information Act, which requires, I always tell people when I was a regulator, if you submit an email or anything to the US government, it will come out. It can come out. The problem, what the difference is, it will be redacted. There'll be parts that are removed. But by law, it is releasable. I think when I was at Upside, I was like, listen, this is an opportunity because we can release this and effectively give away a textbook for free on how to get an approval if we go first. And that's exactly what happened. We talked with FDA and we said, listen, let's release this document as unredacted as humanly possible and tell people how to do this safely. And they agreed.
So you've helped put that dossier together, the one for the Upside Foods. I've actually looked at that. It's about 120 pages long without the appendix, isn't it? It's pretty substantial.
Yeah, I always tell people that safety dossiers are effectively PhD dissertations on a single food ingredient subject. I mean, it's that level of intro. Yeah, and I wrote it because I was a reviewer at FDA, so I was reviewing dossiers before, and I wrote this dossier and led those efforts for Upside. And one of the things I wanted to do was change how we tell a story in a narrative. I went to school for both science and English literature and poetry, and so there's a part of me that wants to, one could say, uplevel the level of storytelling that happens in a federal document. It doesn't have to be a grass application and cut and dry. So we wrote it to be a little bit more, as much as a policy document can be, engaging and more narrative driven, and the through line throughout the story that we were telling, and a lot more examples presented. If you look, we always present an example of something rather than just saying, this is what we're doing, and then you have to try to imagine what we're talking about. So there's lots of contextualization. And effectively, I wrote it as if it would be a textbook or a textbook chapter, and somebody could use it and then figure things out from there.
This was a strategy then, was it, to appeal to the people who had to read it to make it less dry for them so that they'd be happier?
Yes. And I wanted, candidly and somewhat selfishly, wanted the world to copy it. I wanted to give it away. I think it's the best way to approach a dossier. It is, we put an immense amount of thought and time into designing that dossier. And it's not perfect, don't get me wrong. There's places to improve it. But I also wanted companies who didn't have the same regulatory expertise that we did to effectively just go, you know, we're just going to copy this and use it as our template, which is what happened with GRASS, generally recognized as safe. People just copy and paste the previous successful applications. I knew that was going to happen, so I just said, let me just write it so people can plop their data in. And FDA, again, since they had signed off on it, ostensibly agreed.
Yeah, and I'm sure a lot of companies have been doing that. So I suppose there is some potential there for a book, isn't there? But I suppose the industry isn't really big enough yet, is it, to really make anything from a book like that?
Oh man, the political stories are hopefully will make it into the book one day. I think to me, the most interesting part of working at Upside, outside of just like the immense scientific talent that I got to surround myself with for 8 years, was the political intrigue. Because we were playing in the deep end of the pool with some of the most powerful lobbies in the world with deeper pockets than God. And sitting toe to toe with them on so many consequential issues and getting a seat at the table was honestly still one of the most, I can't believe I'm here doing this, moments of my career so far.
Yeah, Upside have been pretty, as I suppose, sort of following on from their sort of regulatory approval and their introduction. They're not doing that great, are they, Upside particularly, or are they? Am I wrong about that?
Not there, so I don't know. But I did see reports that they'd reported that there'd been a reduction in force. If that's true, then again, there's been a mass contraction in the industry, period. I tell people that cultivated meat's in its nuclear winter right now, and precision fermentation is thriving, and plant-based is somewhere in the middle. But that's normal. The hype cycles change. So I think funding has dried up for this cycle for cultivated. I think we're at 90% reduction in funding
Yeah,
this
I
year
wonder
alone.
whether the spring is coming for cultivated meat. You know, I get the sense that sort of 2024 was, like you say, the nuclear winter, but perhaps it's looking slightly more positive. But I agree with you with precision fermentation. That seems to be where people are putting their money, but also in the sort of nuts and bolts of precision fermentation. So actually in the bioreactors themselves, right? That's where a lot of the money's going.
I think the scaling is really hard for any company, any industry. Cultivated is struggling to scale, not because they can't, but because it costs a lot of money. And investors are like, I don't want to spend money to put steel in the ground.
Yeah, I
Here
suppose
we are.
some of the early companies like Upside Food, they had a lot of money, didn't they? Probably had too much money, maybe.
I don't know if you can have too much money to start up. I was on the leadership team. We raised over $600 million. And that is a lot of money, but that is a drop in the bucket to what AI companies are raising right now, with less of an idea and less of an ROI. I think that people just assume, because it's biology, they just assume it's cheap, when it's the exact opposite. Code is cheap, biology, life is expensive. Upside by far raised the most money, but they also, I think it was interesting because we were the most penny pinching company in terms of building how we built things. We built everything as cheaply as possible, not in a bad way, but efficiently. But now I think everyone is just trying to conserve burn and just cash on hand. And so they can survive this to get products out to market. I think with Mission Barnes approval, we've seen we're going to see hopefully a resurgence. I hope a seafood product gets approved. FDA needs to approve a seafood product, which because FDA regulates seafood. And I think we'll see people getting on market. I know Mission Barnes is going to get on market here soon. So I think we just need more competition on market, candidly, instead of just having statewide bans for cultivated meat. And I just think to round this back around, cultivated's just in its, I think, normal hype cycle. It is at the bottom of the hype cycle right now, and it has earned some of that, and I think some of it has been unearned.
I mean, I suppose startups now are probably able to achieve the same as upside, but perhaps with kind of 10% of the funds, maybe.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that this is the way it should be, right? Like you iterate, and companies, I work with companies that have figured out much more efficient ways to do it than I figured out, and that's the way it should be. I think that hopefully, yeah, companies are figuring out how to do this much more efficiently with less capital. I hope companies don't get dissuaded from going in this market because I think there are ways to make money. Also, the B2B side of this is thoroughly unexplored. I started a company, Nextra Bio, with Taryn Wolf, and it's producing food safe scaffolds for cultivated and non-cultivated applications. There's lots of places, like cell culture media, cell line development, bioreactors. We need bioreactor space. So there is just so much opportunity in this space to iterate. But I will tell you the last thing that I'm seeing is I'm pivoting a lot of cultivated companies, or quite a few of them, I should say, into biopharma. They've spent all this time cost reducing and they can't hit commodity pricing, but they can reduce the cost of a biopharmaceutical production. So they're using that and using that to generate revenue sooner. Case in point, Prolific Machines, actually, who started out in cultivated meat and now is making biopharmaceuticals.
Okay, so they're going full circles. They use their technology and they've made it cheaper, and now they're selling the cheaper technology back. That's the plan. That's
Gotta have revenue, gotta have a revenue stream. But yes, at least for some folks.
yeah. I mean, there's lots of, I've noticed, it's not hard to notice that some of the companies now who are coming out, people like Mosa Meat, Meatly, Meatable, they are producing animal fats rather than meat because, for clearly good reason, I suppose, the fats are easier to make, it's easier to scale up, and also because they're not going to be producing that much of it. All they want is the flavor, maybe not the actual kind of textured meat. So it seems like the first wave of cultivated foods might be more fats rather than meat.
Yeah, and also for the very practical reason of if you're doing a monoculture of just one cell type and you're just growing one cell, Fat is a good choice. It's cheap, cheaper, and you don't have to do much with it once you've harvested it. But for example, muscle tissue is a complex, it was a complex differentiated product. It's not homogeneous like fat. Connective tissue is even a little bit hard to make too, even though it is relatively homogeneous. Fat's a good choice if you don't, you just want to sell an ingredient, because most people don't realize this, but fat is the flavor carrier for most species, meaning cow versus tastes like cow because of its fat. Chicken tastes like chicken because of its fat. The protein largely has no flavor. Most people don't realize this, but protein really doesn't have flavor. And then also, you'll hear this from Pat Brown, who founder of Impossible, that the heme component is like the magic molecule for flavor and meat. And while it is certainly a contributor, I think he oversells it. Having run the flavor and sensory department, most for upside, heme is minorly important for meat production in terms of flavor. But the more important flavor is fat, connective tissue, and carrier molecules that participate in the Maillard reaction. But you're right, fat is a very good target to start out.
Yeah. So why did you leave Upside Foods?
I had achieved everything I wanted to do, is a simple answer. I was successful on all fronts. I had spent 8 years at a startup, which is like 30 years at a regular company. I was burnt out, and in the best way possible. I had risen throughout the ranks. I had gotten to create all of the divisions in science that I wanted to create. I achieved many firsts, and I thought it was a good time to part ways on a high note. And I also wanted to relocate down to Los Angeles, down from the Bay Area. So I just wanted to try something new and build new things and figure out what I wanted to do next. And then I launched Good Humans and have been running ever since.
It's a great CV to have, isn't it? To launch into something else in the space. It's almost ideal, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been super fun. I really encourage a lot of people, if you're considering a career in biology, to consider alternative proteins. I think it's one of the most rewarding things I've ever done with my life, because not because the, of course, the mission and impact is really important, but honestly, because of the people. I have never gotten to work with so many varied, talented people. I don't think I'll ever get to work with this many talented people ever again, because of the unique nexus that alternative protein brought together, has brought together. So if you're considering this as a career, I think there's a sweet little window that's will eventually close as it becomes an established field. But for now, you really get the benefit of working with people who you probably would never ever talk to in your career if you come to alternative proteins.
Yeah, and I suppose it's all because the vast majority of them are doing it because it's a mission rather than just a job. I guess it's a raison d'être for them.
That's right.
So
Yeah,
that's.
it absolutely. And I always tell people, like, I don't agree. Don't follow your passion. That's terrible advice given by people with very privileged careers. I always assume you have a lot of money if you say follow your passion. I always tell people follow systemic problems like climate change and like food distribution. Find something you can mission align to and work from that perspective, because you can enjoy it and feel like you're doing good and be gainfully employed your entire life. Unfortunately, systemic problems usually take a long time to solve.
Yeah.
Food's one of them.
So to go back to something you talked about a little bit earlier, about there was you said that you were in these board meetings with very senior kind of policy makers and probably government people and can lobby industries and things like that. So do you think the cultivated meat space is still facing a lot of pushback from these people? And if so, what do you think is the answer to that, or is it going to stifle growth?
At the federal level, I don't think there's much pushback, candidly, from even conventional meat. I think it's even worse. There's indifference. For years, this was on their radar, and now it's, I think, candidly not. Like at the state level here, there's states that are banning it, and that's just because small groups are getting upset and then causing lobbying their state. But at the federal level, they really get this. The conventional meat industry largely supported and agreed with it. They were like, yeah, let's give people a chance. Let's let the market decide. If people don't want to buy it, they won't buy it. But if they will, were interested. Very few were actually actively against these products. And then regulatorily too, politically, very few people were openly anti products because everyone supported innovation and wants to feed people. That's a very easy thing to get behind, regardless of your political party. And I worked with the first Trump administration and then the Biden administration. Didn't have any issues with either. Like they both agreed and understood the meaning behind and like what we were trying to do. And of course, like American like leadership in the bioeconomy space. So what's happened though since then is people don't care. I think they've moved on to other topics du jour. And I think it started around COVID. When COVID happened, the conventional meat industry are globally turned inward because they faced shortages. And then the plant-based world took a dive in the last few years in terms of sales, as you're aware of too. And then so there's just been this depression of alternative protein sales across the board. So I think most people are just not even paying attention. They're not winning in the marketplace, so I won't care. I do think they will care if somebody starts jumping out in front like a plant-based milk, right? So plant-based milks are about 13-14% of the market. Oh, they care. Dairy cared once they hit 10%, once they hit 5%. If we can get to 10% penetration in a market, boy, that's a multi-billion-dollar a year business. And I guarantee you the conventional meat industry will be paying attention as well as the federal regulators. But until then, we're just small potatoes.
Yeah, I just launched a podcast today, which I did with Jeff Trepishin from Meatable, and he was telling me that they because the demand for protein is going to increase by 70% over the next 25 years or something, and the population by 2 billion. So really, the farmers and the ranchers are not going to be impacted by cultivated meat, because cultivated meat is just going to take the additional burden away from production. So it's all
Yeah, I don't think everyone thinks that deeply about it, but you're right. Cultivated would take the delta in the increased demand and all alternative proteins too. Like all alternatives cultivated could fit within that delta with room to spare and be multi-billion dollar industries. That's how large the meat industry is. But I think that they will care if it starts eating into their margins. But again, that's a even at the in the best case scenario, I still think a 20 to 30 year horizon. Like cultivated companies need to just put products on market and they need to do it as cost competitive as possible, safely, obviously. And they just need to be available wherever you buy meat. And right now you can't, I think you can only buy them in a few places globally in very in handful quantities.
Yeah. I do think the media has had a big hand in the kind of the downfall of plant-based foods, and especially plant-based foods. And I suppose Upside did have some negative media, didn't it? So how influential do you think the media is in the growth of this industry?
Well, as someone whose father is a journalist and worked in news his entire career, I can tell you considerable. And I have had the privilege of working with journalists with a lot of integrity and an ethical code. And then not so some fly-by-night operations and what have you, and you can't always win. But you're right. Every industry is fair game, and the press is there to keep people honest. So I'm very upfront about the fact that I'm like, the press are just doing their job. If they're doing it in good faith. However, I think that I definitely feel like on certain occasions, I experienced people who had a personal bias that they let integrate into their stories rather than letting the story tell itself. And I think that's the minority, candidly. I think that the criticism that's leveled at the industry, I think by and large, if it's done in good faith, is fair. Again, I'm a scientist, like you have to criticize. That's how we improve. For example, companies haven't figured out scale this, Alex. Like nobody has figured out scale, even in the plant-based world, because not because we don't know how to do it, it's because how large the food industry is. Like the scales are unimaginably large. Like a small meat processing plant in the United States can produce 1 million pounds of meat a week. That is an un that even if you convert that to kilograms, it's still so much food to produce. And that's a small facility. So, cultivated facilities saying they're going to crack 15 million pounds of cultivated per year, which sounds impressive and is a drop in the bucket compared to conventional products. Like the competition to be able to compete requires hundreds of millions, billions, if we can get there, pounds of meat. We're just not there yet.
No. So it takes kind of government assistance, doesn't it, to really get to that scale. Kind of media wise, it's yes, I agree that obviously people need to be challenged, but there are a lot of articles that kind of relied on headlines that sort of said things like vegan food gives you cancer or something, it was bad for your.
Oh yeah, but I feel like those stories are as old as time. There's green on one side, there's greenwashing where everything is good, and the other side, there's fear mongering. I've seen it all in terms of just like how they position alternative products. And yeah, we all want our products to be covered in a positive light. I think the thing that I wish, and if you're a journalist listening to this, is for the love of God, understand the science that you're reporting on. It's one thing to criticize it, but it's very obvious many times that we're criticizing something without understanding it or presenting it in a nuanced way. And I beg of thee to at least speak and try to understand the science that you're reporting on.
Yeah, I suppose it's difficult for a journalist to understand the sort of nuance of the science. They could get an overview, but to go into the detail, it's probably asking a bit much, isn't it?
That's why we need more scientists as journalists. And again, I understand the need that they have deadlines. They're not going to be able to get through this. And again, this is someone whose father literally spent 40 years doing this and believes in the fourth estate. But like even in my family, my father would tell his staff, if you don't understand it, we're not going to air. So like you have to demonstrate basic competency before you write about a piece. So otherwise we're never going to hear the end of it. We lose credibility when people and experts just dismiss us as a sort of hogwash.
So Eric, it's been wonderful to have you on Future Foods Interviews. I'm going to ask you one more question before we go. Clearly, you are pretty well entrenched in this industry. You are perhaps more than most. So how do you stay informed and inspired in this kind of rapidly evolving field? What resources and practices would you recommend to others who are interested in this area? Just educate themselves and keep informed.
I think number one, and not to be too shameless, but listening to podcasts like yours, I think this is a great way for us to share our knowledge. I also host my own podcast, Food Truths, on the Spoon Podcast Network, which is a slightly different flavor of food science and what have you and politics. But I think this is like how people put us on in the background and listen. But in terms of staying inspired, I also care a lot about the policies and stuff. So I read what's called Food Fix by Helena Bottomiller-Evich, who's a former Politico journalist who writes some of the best food policy. And then Larisa Zimbaroff, who wrote the book Technically Food, also writes a Substack that's fantastic. And then Elaine Watson, the perennial journalist in this space, who's a little bit more industry focused. She's amazing. Just following where it's going. But I think for like broad trends and optimistic takes, the Good Food Institute is generally where things are at. And then lastly, the Tufts University Cell Cultured Agriculture Center, TUCA, is also a really good resource led by David Kaplan over there. I don't know. There's lots of ways. I think that we're just seeing the next evolution of a field. I think cultivated will be just fine ultimately as it survives this nuclear winter. It will emerge. We'll have some winnowing. We'll have some companies that win, go to market. And we will see a brand new field emerge as a result. And I don't know what that is, but I will be excited to be a part of it.
Yes, I am also very excited to be a part of it. And I suppose that's why I do what I'm doing. It's nice to feel like you're part of something which is an emerging technology and it's actually something that's hopefully good for the planet, good for people, good for the animals, and overall a wholesome sort of thing to be involved in. It's great to meet other people who are on that same mission. So thank you very much for coming on Future of Foods, Eric, and we'll stay in touch and I'll be watching with interest your next moves.
Thank you very much.